It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's presidential primary is set for April. We check in on the Republican presidential nominating process as New Hampshire voters selected former President Donald Trump over former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley in the first primary in the nation. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, your reaction, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. Lily, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me on this morning. It's great to be here.
So former President Donald Trump wins the Republican New Hampshire primary with 54% of the vote, also winning the Iowa caucuses last week. Has Trump already wrapped up the Republican nomination?
It seems pretty much more likely than not. And this is also what the polls have been reflecting for quite some time. Nikki Haley has not dropped out of the race, and she's his most ardent contender at this point. And she's also asked for a two-person race. And so now she has that because Ron DeSantis dropped out over the weekend. But I do think it's more likely than not that Trump will be the Republican nominee.
It seems like we've heard the sentiment, though, that Americans don't want a Biden-Trump rematch. And yet here we are, like, closing in on one. How do you see that?
Well, again, you're not seeing necessarily all that competitive a primary on the Democratic side. Mm-hmm. There usually isn't one when the incumbent president is from the party, either the Democrats or the Republicans. And so, at this point, it's likely that Joe Biden will be the Democratic nominee. And so that left, who would the Republicans choose? And there were quite a few people contending for it. But the entire time that we've been looking at this and that, you've had people running for the nomination, Trump has been far ahead in the polls, his other colleagues quite far behind him. So the setup was kind of looking like it was going to be a rematch between Trump and Biden, and it's continuing to look that way. And in a lot of ways, it's a sort of strange rematch between two incumbents, one mm-hmm. actual incumbent, Joe Biden, because he is the incumbent president at this point, and one recent incumbent in Donald Trump. And so that is an interesting and unique situation.
Now, as we examine Nikki Haley staying in the race, has her sights set on the February 24th primary in South Carolina, where she was governor. What does Haley need to do to shift the dynamics of this race?
Well, she needs to appeal to quite a few of the Republican-based voters who are otherwise going to support Donald Trump. And she's been trying to do that. Obviously, she tried to do it to a degree in Iowa, and even more so in New Hampshire. And as many sort of analysts and pundits have noted, that New Hampshire was kind of tailor-made for Nikki Haley's message. And because independents can vote in the Republican or Democratic mm-hmm. Contest in New Hampshire, it means that there were a lot of folks who would indicate themselves as independents who were able to vote for Nikki Haley, and yet she still was not able to, come within even 10 points of Donald Trump. So she's looking at South Carolina, which has been a good state for Donald Trump in the past. It is her home state, obviously, and it is a place where she was governor. But the disposition of the electorate there is more inclined towards Trump than it is towards Haley.
We're talking about the 2024 presidential campaign. Lily Gorin, political scientist at Carroll University in Waukesha, is here. You can join in with questions, comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Haley said she called it her sweet state of South Carolina, that being her next one, the next primary for her. But it's like a month away. Does that Does that distance help or hurt Haley, do you think?
I have a feeling it may be more problematic than an asset, because it's, you know, it's going to have a long period of time of campaigning in the state. And, you know, if the poll numbers don't reflect her having strength in the state against Trump, because there will be polls that will take place between now and the election there, it may in fact lead her to possibly leave the race earlier. Because we do have this now really long, we have a month before this South Carolina primary. So if polls don't sort of show her getting close to Trump, that may be an indication to her and her funders that this is just is not going to happen.
You have to keep the campaign funded enough for her to stay on the airwaves as well, I would imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's also Nevada sort of close in there as well. And if you're going to continue from South Carolina and Nevada, you've got to prime yourself for Super Tuesday, which is a huge number of states voting all together.
And, you know, I would imagine Haley and the team around her are trying to hold on for that moment when, like, over a dozen states hold primaries on Super Tuesday.
And again, that's, you know, you have to have a lot of money to advertise in all those states and get to them as well. You know, so she's going to spend a lot of time in South Carolina now campaigning, then she's not going to be campaigning in other states as well.
Wisconsin's primary is set for April 2nd. Could either the Democratic or Republican presidential primaries in Wisconsin have any effect on the race?
It's possible. It's improbable, but it's possible. So I never want to tell people, you know, not to vote, because one of the things I do as a political scientist is advocate participation in democracy. But I'm not sure when we reach April 2nd if we won't already know who is likely to be the two nominees.
So Jeff from Delafield called in and is wondering how much of Trump's support is from Democrats or Democratic-minded voters voting for him in the primary with the idea that he's beatable in the general election in November.
Well, I mean, again, if we're looking at this state by state, I would say in Iowa, not likely to be the case at all. Because it was a caucus, because you had to actually come out on a very, very, very cold night, that it is unlikely that there were very many Democrats who came to the caucuses to support Trump in that way. New Hampshire is a little bit of a different sort of situation, and there may have been some. But if we're looking at polling in other states, you're polling people who are, you know, in the screens, you're sort of asking them, are they Democrats? Are they Republicans? And obviously people can, you know, say something that's not actually accurate when they're polled. But, you know, it seems like there weren't a lot of Democrats who came out to vote for Donald Trump in New Hampshire. In part because a lot of folks were potentially trying to vote for somebody who they thought would potentially more likely be less of a threat, shall I say, to democracy. And that seemed to be what independents and people who were possibly crossing over from other parties were doing there.
We get analysis on the Republican presidential primary season with Carroll University political science professor Lily Gorin. And there's room to discuss. Call in with a question. You can share your views at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Presidential primary season is underway. Wisconsin's is set for April 2nd. with former President Donald Trump fresh off a win in New Hampshire over former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. Let's hear your thoughts. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lily Gorin is a political science and global studies professor at Carroll University and stays with us. Let's bring in Celia in Madison. Hi, Celia.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking the call. I have one comment and one question. I've been involved in politics and government all of my life, and I'm old from the time I was 16 here in Wisconsin. And I lived in the East for many years, and what I saw and I see a bit in the Midwest is that Democratic candidates were reluctant to campaign in rural areas or eager to sit in the state assemblies because they had, shall we say, low opinions of country people. And I know of one district in Illinois that was the case. So it seems the Democrats may be losing their own races if they're not really taking all the population seriously. But my question is, last time I looked at political statistics, 40% of the population evenly split between Democrats and Republicans were independents. So for primaries, does Professor Gorin know how many states in which you have to be registered Republicans, or how many states, I think like New Hampshire, independents could vote?
Celia, thank you for that. Lily, go ahead.
The states have different rules with regard to who can vote and if they are, quote, open or closed primaries. And more states have opportunities for what we would call sort of more open primaries, which is you can go in and take a ballot for the Republicans or for the Democrats. You don't have to be registered with any particular party to do so. And so that there are opportunities for people to cross over who could be Democrats or who regularly vote Democrats and take a Republican ballot, or the other way around. There are fewer states that are we know as closed at this point, that you have to have been registered or connected to a particular party and that you only can get that party's ballot. There are far fewer of those at this point. Most people who are primary voters tend to be more enthusiastic, quote, base voters. So it's less likely that they are people who, don't have a particular inclination. And oftentimes, you don't have the same kinds of numbers and turnout that you do in a general election during the primaries as well, because mm-hmm. it is usually drilled down to those more enthusiastic, more committed base voters.
Can you speak to the rural and urban divide in political campaign strategy?
I am not an expert on that in any capacity, but I have not seen very much by way of Democratic reluctance to campaign in rural areas, nor Republican reluctance to necessarily campaign in urban areas. And you go where your voters are likely to be. And so that is often what, sort of directs people in their campaign strategies, is trying to reach the most voters that mm-hmm. you're likely to get, or more voters that you're likely to get. And lots of states are like Wisconsin, which have urban areas, suburban areas, and rural areas. I think we have seen over the years candidates coming or not coming, as was the case in 2016 in the Clinton campaign, to Wisconsin, to various areas in Wisconsin, too.
JJ in Green Bay called in and is wondering, how are former President Trump's legal troubles going to affect his candidacy?
Well, there's a lot of analysis and discussion of this at this point, in part because some of the situations where he needs to, quote, be in court are going to take him off the campaign trail. But what some folks are suggesting, and I think that this is fairly accurate, is that he's using those court appearances and also his comments before and after he is in a courtroom as essentially campaign stops in their own right, so that he is talking to voters and potential constituents about his legal situations and sort of making the case that he is, you know, he is being targeted. And so that he's sort of turning some of these court cases into a kind of venue for him to make his case to voters.
In order to stump. Yeah. And here's a follow-up. Brian in Door County is wondering, with the pending court cases against Trump, if he's found guilty and declared ineligible to run, who would be the Republican on the ticket? Brian says maybe Nikki Haley is hoping to stay in the race just in this scenario.
Anything is possible in that regard. And of course, we have to get to the point where Donald Trump would be declared ineligible, which is not necessarily a simple thing. Even if he were convicted, that doesn't mean he can't run for president. And so I think that, you know, Nikki Haley and to a degree Ron DeSantis were actually in the race to kind of sort of be there in case something like that came to pass. And we still have quite a few months, obviously, until the general election in November. So it is possible that, you know, one of these other candidates who was running this cycle would step in or be, you know, sort of appointed.
Just because you suspend doesn't mean you couldn't do the opposite, I suppose.
Exactly. You could re-engage.
Lily Gorin, political scientist at Carroll University in Waukesha, and fielding your questions on presidential primary season. You can join in 800-642-1234. Kevin in Janesville is here. Kevin, hi.
Hey, good morning. My frustration is that at this point of the primary season, fewer than a quarter of a million people have decided for the rest of the country who's going to be in and who's not going to be in. If the system were more of a proportionality of the vote, gets that number of delegates, would that encourage more people to stay in the race for longer so that later states actually do have a voice? Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Lily.
Well, you know, again, this is the nominating process that we have is interesting and complicated. And I understand exactly Kevin's frustration, because it does sort of feel like it's ending before it really even began. And, you know, the parties themselves are the ones who structure the way that they nominate their candidates. And so we moved from, you know, sort of closed door, cigar smoke filled rooms to these more sort of democratic, small d democratic ways of selecting candidates. But it certainly is not a perfect system.
Vice President Kamala Harris, as you know, visited Wisconsin this week advocating for reproductive rights, including the right to an abortion. Democrats have benefited in recent elections from promoting abortion rights. Do you think will abortion as an issue outweigh other issues like the economy or immigration this year?
I don't know that it will outweigh it, but I think it will be a key issue that people are considering in casting their ballots in November, not just for the president, but also for other elected officials in their states, particularly because that's also where some of these decisions are being made around abortion and abortion policies. I would also say that it's likely that some states will also have abortion issues on the ballot themselves, which may also draw out people to vote in terms of what the ballot issue is around abortion. So I think immigration, I think the economy, I think abortion are all going to be top line issues for voters.
And really quickly here, will Wisconsin's vote be a deciding factor once again? Are we decidedly a battleground state?
I believe that we are.
We are.
And
so Wisconsin, you know, being that pivotal swing state, I would imagine you will see the campaigns coming through here frequently?
Yeah, I mean, and again, we have already seen that. Obviously, yeah. we've seen the president and the vice president here. We've seen Trump here on occasion. We are going to have the Republican National Committee here for their convention. I have a feeling that there will be a lot of folks coming through Wisconsin in the next 8 months.
Lily, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on this morning.
Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. And for disclosure, Carroll University is a business sponsor of WPR. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin dance and cheer squads are preparing for state championships. We explore the athleticism involved and how these sports are judged. But first, in the last 2 years, hundreds of new immigrants and asylum seekers have settled in Whitewater. And this month, officials there sent a letter to President Joe Biden asking for help dealing with the changes that it is causing. Evan Casey reports on how the newcomers are affecting the city and its residents.
Byron spent 17 days traveling from Nicaragua through Central America to get to the United States. He left his past life behind in search of a better one in America.
I might have better opportunities here because that's what I aim here. Try to find a better place to live, try to feel safe, try to work hard.
Nicaragua is an authoritarian regime, and Byron is now seeking asylum here in America. He didn't want his last name used in this story out of concerns for his safety. When he reached the U.S.-Mexico border, he was allowed to be received by friends where they live, in Whitewater, Wisconsin. At the home's kitchen table, Byron wears a black AC/DC shirt and a crucifix around his neck. He's growing his hair out. The cold is still something he's getting used to, and he thinks it'll help him stay warmer in the winter. But the 27-year-old also says he feels happy and grateful to be here.
I really like it. I mean, I love, that's why I never moved from Whitewater. I'm not planning to move, actually.
Byron is just one of the recent immigrants who have settled in the small college town in the past few years. Many of them are refugees from Nicaragua or Venezuela. The city estimates there could be anywhere from 800 to 1,000 of them now living in the city of 15,000. Juana Barajas owns a Mexican grocery store with her family on Main Street. She's now offering items with the Nicaraguan and Venezuelan flags on them and is even making different types of food for the newcomers.
Now, of course, I'm making food, Mexican food, but I'm making like a lot of nacatamales, a lot of, you know, caldos. Well, they don't call them caldos, they call them sopa.
Marjorie Stoneman, who leads the community group Whitewater Unites Lives, also says it's important to welcome the newcomers.
We really want to make sure that people recognize that newcomers to our town are welcome and that we respect everybody, where they're from, no matter where they're from or what their religion or what their beliefs are.
But the arrivals haven't come without new challenges for the city, as the newcomers have strained public services. Whitewater Police Chief Dan Meyer says in 1 week in January 2022, the city experienced a few major incidents that spurred a citywide discussion about how to deal with the influx. He says police found a family with a 3-year-old and a 2-year-old living inside a 10-by-10 shed in below zero temperatures. They also found two young children living in an empty building where a fire started.
In a very short span of time, it couldn't be more clear that we had an issue that was needed to be addressed immediately.
Meyer wants to see new funding for an immigrant liaison position and more officers. Ultimately, he says his goal is to better serve the new population.
Whether or not the numbers, you know, say it's 200 or it's 2,000, what matters is our statistics point to a huge need for resources.
Some law enforcement and politicians have claimed that some of the immigrants are connected to the illegal drug trade. Meyer says it's too soon to know if that's actually occurring or not. Southeastern Wisconsin may seem like an unlikely place for such immigration, but many migrants make decisions the same way Byron did. They go where they know someone. When one family or group settles in a spot, they tell others it's safe to come. Immigration attorney Mark Christopher says he believes similar stories are occurring across Wisconsin and other smaller Midwestern cities. He says it could be years until asylum cases for many of the new immigrants are completed. In the meantime, he says they're hard workers and do their best to fit in.
They acclimate themselves into our schools and our community, and in my experience, they bring an extra positive element to any community.
That's been the case for Byron. He's now volunteering at a food pantry to help others like him. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. High school dance and cheer teams from across Wisconsin will meet for the state championships to be held in La Crosse and Appleton, respectively. And we explore the skills, the creativity, the athleticism, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have two representatives from the Wisconsin Association of Cheer and Pom Coaches. Jim Ward is co-chair for the dance committee. Jim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning, and Carrie Lidke is president of the association. Carrie, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Carrie, let's start with you. As the state championships draw near, how are teams preparing each day leading up to these competitions?
So a lot of teams right now are wrapping up their appearances at local events and taking the feedback from the officials at those events and implementing them into their practices right now. A lot of cleanup, attention to details, I would say, and also working to, you know, review, you know, where do they stand in regards to the rules that guide our sports as well, making sure that they are, you know, dotting I's and crossing their T's right now.
What are some things that stand out there in the rules that we should be aware of for, you know, people who are not involved in the sport?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the two highest areas is making sure that their apparel is compliant with our National Federation of High School Standard or Schools rules, as well as our state rules, you know, making sure that they have, you know, talked with those officials to make sure that the appropriateness and the legalities are being met. In addition to that, they're also looking at how they're performing their skills as well. Both cheer and dance have so much athleticism built into them. So it could be how they are bearing their weight as they land a particular trick, to how they are executing their lifts and their stunts and their routines to make sure that they are meeting those standards.
You know, Jim, as the state championships approach, the nerves can also get a little bit frazzled. How do you keep, you know, the excitement and the energy up for these students?
Well, I think the students really come to the competition, particularly regional and state, prepared. You know, they start early in the year. In fact, many of the schools, the dance teams and cheer teams, will begin their season in June, because they will have tryouts, and then they will go to camps to learn routines, and then they will start working on their routines. So by the time we get to January and February for competitions, I think all the teams are pretty confident, and they're trying to clean up or perfect some of the part of the choreography or the skills that they are including in their routines. But by the time they get to regional or state, they're ready to go. And they have done it so many times that, of course, there will be nerves that kick in. But we always say, go out and do your best and really enjoy the experience more than anything else.
I've heard the word cleanup now a couple times here, Jim, and I'm wondering, you know, what strategies do these teams use to, you know, become more synchronized in their moves during these performances?
I think that you have to, as a coach, understand your skill level of your team, what will look good, what can you do to perfection, synchronizing those parts of the routines. And it really is just repetitive practice over and over again. A small skill that may take just a few seconds, but is important to your routine and they will spend a lot of time on those types of details.
And Jim, you bring some numbers with you that there are nearly 4,000 dance and cheer athletes on 111 teams who competed through the association, and you think that's going to continue to grow. What is driving the interest?
I think that several things. I think our cheer and dance athletes want to represent their high schools. They want to be a part of the high school experience. And we recognize that both cheer and dance teams, they will participate in parades, 4th of July parades. They will be at every or many of the high school football and basketball games for both boys and girls teams. And then they go to competitions and they go to community service events. So not only do they compete and earn awards and also earn an athletic letter, many of the dancers, probably the more advanced, they're also looking at those to be college opportunities. Many colleges will recruit cheerleaders and dancers, offer scholarships to them. So really the range of where you are, and I think just the popularity of seeing it on TV and just the popularity of cheer and dance. And we are seeing an increase in the number of athletes participating this year over last.
Carrie, you've been a coach for decades. Do Wisconsin high schools provide enough funding for dance and cheer teams compared to other team sports like football or basketball?
You know, if we had to do numbers to numbers, I would say that definitely the cheer and dance teams often end up on the lower end of that scale. You know, and a lot of it does have to do with the tradition of funding within districts that is different across the board. There's going to be some districts who are viewing and treating their programs for cheer and dance as an athletic activity and therefore providing budgets for it. And then there are others who have not gotten to that point and still look at it from the view of an extracurricular activity and may not necessarily have the budgeting that they can put forth to it. I do think that because of that tradition, a lot of teams have become very self-sufficient in that they, you know, have been very creative in how they are creating funds so that they can support their activity.
Meaning that individual teams are fundraising in order to travel, for uniforms, for other incidentals?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like any sport, there's always the gear and the apparel, the commitments, as you've mentioned, you know, travel that come along with it. And the more successful a team, the more you can add on to that calendar. So really, the fundraising has become very crucial for so many programs to be able to provide the resources and the tools that the teams need in order to enter into that competitive arena.
Carrie Litke is president of the Wisconsin Association of Cheer and Pom Coaches. Jim Ward is here, co-chair of the association's dance committee, as we discuss cheer and dance and the state championships coming up. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
Come on and lift your glass. You've won your own free pass to be our guest. If you're stressed, it's fine dining, we suggest. Be our guest, be our guest, be our guest.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are listening to Be Our Guest from Disney's 1991 animated movie Beauty and the Beast. Hudson High School won last year's statewide dance competition in the kick division, performing to this song. Ahead of this year's Dance and Cheer Championships, we're in conversation with two representatives from the Wisconsin Association of Cheer and Pom Coaches. Jim Ward is co-chair of the dance committee, and Carrie Litke is president of the association. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Carrie, what makes a good song for dance competitions?
Well, dance or cheer, really. I think that often teams are going to choose something that they can relate to or have a sense of buy-in. Definitely, I would say that their selections are going to be something that will allow them to have that artistic expression and take on character and give life to their routines. There's a lot of storytelling that happens through dance and cheer routines that you could choose anything just off the radio and bust a move, but to be able to really relate, you know, what people are hearing to the movement that they are seeing is really special.
Jim, how do you know when the music clicks, when the music complements a routine?
I think when you are an audience member, just like you're going to a concert or watching a movie or a TV show, when it moves you and when it gives you meaning and you can relate to it. I think that's what the teams are really trying to do, is to connect with the audience and not only show their skill, but make it a memorable performance.
But that audience, they could be very young, they could be old, they come from all walks of life. So how do you approach choreography with so many different types of people who are watching it?
I think you determine what your style is, the type of genre you're going to compete in. In our dance competitions, you can compete in two of the four genres, which are palm, hip hop, kick, and jazz. So once you determine that, and many of the schools traditionally will compete in certain genres, then I think you look at the skills that your athletes have that season. And as a coach or as a choreographer, you design your routine based on all of those different elements.
Carrie, what kind of physical conditioning is needed to meet the physical demands of these sports?
Yeah, you know, our athletes, we think about what they're doing in the span of 2 minutes and 30 seconds. It's just an awful lot. Both sports have to exert a lot of energy, not only physically, but also through voice. And so there is a ton of cardio that is happening. Many teams are implementing running or, even something as fun as Zumba, which is very relatable, I think, to everybody. Mm-hmm. And then there's also going to be that element of working their flexibility and strength conditioning that you will find that they're implementing, and a lot of technique. There's a lot of isolation of movement that creates that muscle memory, but it's also building muscle at the same time.
And being thrown in the air. I mean, just thinking about, those stunts and the, what safety is going in to execute them. And I'm just wondering, can you talk about those types of throws and how you learn them?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as coaches, I think a lot of times we're relating to the kids about how the physics of what they do absolutely matters and makes a difference. There is a lot of discussion about how proper lifting works with our bodies. I think if you imagine just lifting a heavy box, and if you're going to throw it, I think the average person would probably approach it not with a legs first type of idea versus I'm just going to grab it and I'm going to throw, and while you're throwing with your back, and that's not going to get the greatest height. It's not going to feel good. So I think that there is a lot of work through progressions of skills, starting from the very simplest of skills where you are teaching the dynamics and the base of proper lifting to the point where, you have to learn how to release a skill and recatch a body. And it really takes everybody who is involved in that to make it work. So there's a ton of time that is spent into the safety mechanics of not just talking about it, but actually practicing catching properly and everybody understanding what their role is in regards to making sure that they can make their environment safe for themselves and the person that's going up in the air.
We're talking about dance and cheer athletes in Wisconsin ahead of next month's state championships. And we have Carrie Litke here and Jim Ward from the Wisconsin Association of Cheer and Pom Coaches. You can join in questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234. You know, Jim, you say that cheer and dance are historically viewed as primarily female sports. Is that dynamic still the case today?
No, we're seeing more and more male athletes participate on the cheer side. There are co-ed divisions, and we are seeing, if you go to a college game, you're going to see the need for many more male cheerleaders than sometimes even female cheerleaders on some of the squads because of the strength and the lifting. But also on the dance side as well, I think shows like So You Think You Can Dance on TV and other dance shows are inspiring male athletes. Many of the athletes will start at studio or rec programs, and then they will evolve into their high school because they, as I said, they want to be a part of the high school experience. So we are seeing more males in both cheer and dance.
Carrie, how do judges measure a good performance? What is behind the judging?
Gosh, there's so much to be said for that. I think, you know, there is a math to understanding how they are placing one team ahead the next. There's a lot of criteria and drivers that break down everything from the sharpness of their movement, the synchronization of their movement, the storytelling of the choreography. There's all of these different units of measure that they're looking at. You know, the ability for teams to do difficult skills, but then also how well did they execute those skills. So there's an awful lot of training that our judges have to go through in order to get through the complexities of a score sheet.
Do they watch a routine with fresh eyes, or do they know the elements of it before it is delivered, performed?
So, you know, there are going to be some of our judges who may be officiating at local events and then are at that ranking where they are then hired at our state level events. So there's a very real chance that they may have seen a routine prior to that event. However, our theory really is that, especially when we're educating our judges, is to evaluate what they are seeing that day.
And
let go of any biases that they may have and really evaluate the athletes on how they are performing
right
that
before
routine
then.
On that day.
Yeah. Carrie and Jim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Carrie, thank you for having us.
Carrie Litke, president of the Wisconsin Association of Cheer and Pom Coaches. Jim Ward is co-chair for the dance committee. The state cheer and dance championships take place next month in La Crosse and Appleton. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As drivers face rising premiums, we examine the causes of vehicle insurance rate increases in Wisconsin and nationwide. The cost of auto insurance is outpacing inflation, according to the Insurance Information Institute, and analysts forecast little relief this year. Join the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler Leberty is an associate professor of risk and insurance at the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. Tyler, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So this Market Watch analysis indicating the average full coverage premium in Wisconsin rose almost 40% from 2022 to 2023. Why are car insurance rates rising at such a clip?
Well, there's multiple factors behind it, so we can't just point to one cause. Inflation does have something to do with it. Well, you know, inflation has somewhat cooled over the last year. Insurance companies can only price every 6 months to a year, and so inflation somewhat has a delayed reaction on insurers, severe weather. But I think probably the primary causes have been the cost of car repairs and replacements.
Cost of car repairs and replacements. Is that means that as the cost of cars go up, that it becomes pricier to fix or to total?
Yes. So obviously inflation has impact on this as well. But the cars themselves have had a lot more technology in them. A lot of electric vehicles create some pricing issues for insurers. And as a result, it's just costlier to repair, find replacement parts. And there were low inventories, especially during COVID period. And so that led to increasing costs for insurers.
Have insurers figured out how to price the EV market with premiums, or is this kind of new ground still?
Yeah, so it is new ground. They don't have as much data on it. That's insurance companies like to have a lot of information and data, and just given the somewhat newness of electric vehicles, they don't have as much. But the insurers are getting somewhat more comfortable pricing electric vehicles. It is more expensive to insure electric vehicle. In fact, Teslas continue to be the most expensive car models on the market to insure. Because they sort of have higher upfront and repair costs than other vehicles.
So when you look state by state, there's a bank rate report showing Florida as the most expensive state to buy full coverage auto insurance at almost $4,000 a year. How does Wisconsin's insurance rates for cars compare to other states?
Well, while it might not feel like it, Wisconsin's actually one of the cheaper states. It's probably ranked the ninth lowest average auto insurance premium among the 50 states. And so the average cost of full coverage is projected to be in 2024 about $1,500, which is lower than the national average, about $2,000.
I felt that when I moved from Louisiana some years ago. There was a big difference in a positive way.
Yeah, so Louisiana is right behind Florida as being the next highest. Yeah.
But, I guess, how does your state or how does your zip code even affect what you pay?
Yeah, so that's a big rating factor of where you live, mainly because it's where you drive. And so density of population, risk factors like auto thefts and likelihood of getting into an auto accident, it's going to be driven by location. And so zip code is a big factor determining the price.
Basically, like more claims in your area, even though you don't have a claim, that could actually affect that policy and what you pay.
Yes, if it's related to the actual location, in the sense if there's a lot of car thefts or car break-ins in a certain zip code, even though your car hasn't been impacted, the probability of your car being affected by this in the future is going to increase, and therefore insurance companies have to factor it into that prices.
We're looking at the factors about the recent rise in auto insurance premiums. Tyler Leverty with us, Associate Professor of Risk and Insurance at UW-Madison. You can call in with your questions. You can share your concerns at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler, the head of the Insurance Information Institute, told NPR that riskier driving behavior is contributing to rising auto insurance rates. Are motorists driving more dangerous today than in previous years?
So I think the biggest cause of that is that cell phone usage while driving is becoming the primary cause of sort of this distracted driving increase. And so that's leading to a rise in accidents, injuries, and fatalities. And I think that's what the III, the Insurance Information Institute report, is trying to profile when they talk about the increase in risky driving.
And meanwhile, last year, the Milwaukee Police Department noted a significant spike in reckless driving citations being issued. Does reckless driving affect auto insurance rates on a city-by-city basis?
Absolutely, yes. So that has been an increase, an especially increase during the pandemic, because there were less cars on the road. And so this led to people feeling comfortable speeding and driving at higher rates of speed, and that led to, you know, higher severity accidents.
What is the effect of like a citation, or what is the effect of a speeding ticket on your rate and what the insurer is going to offer you in the premium?
Well, so simple lineup is that it's going to increase your premium. So drivers with a traffic violation are going to see an average car insurance rate in about 50% in 2024. And if you get into an accident, probably even higher than that.
50% higher I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, yeah, 50% on average across the United States.
Across the United States, okay. What if, like, you're in an accident, it's not your fault? Could that affect your rate?
So the short answer is, unfortunately, yes, it could affect your rate because it speaks to where you're driving. And even though it's, you know, completely not your fault, you got into an accident, and it makes it more likely that you'll get into future accidents.
Could Wisconsin's insurance commissioner step in at any point to reduce costs to drivers? Is this something that the insurance office would be watching?
So first, I think they would be watching this, absolutely, especially as we've seen 2 years of price increases, substantial price increases in auto insurance. 12% in 2024 is projected, and then last year they increased on average about 11% across the country. Now, speaking to whether the insurance regulator can do something about that, I think that's tricky. When the regulator sort of intervenes, what they're going to do is sort of put a cap on prices, and that's problematic because that creates an availability problem, which will likely just increase prices in the future. And so a lot of research suggests that they probably shouldn't do that. Markets are more efficient when regulators don't intervene on pricing.
Let's bring in a call. Denny in Wapaka is here. Denny, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. My question to the guest is, I am a businessman. I own two businesses. But right now, most of the data I'm reading in The Economist, Wall Street Journal, and others are that the major price increases in our country, including inflation, are about half driven by flat gouging. And I am a businessman. My cost of products have gone up that I purchased to resell have gone up 45% in the last 24 months. How much of the insurance increase is just profit taking?
Thanks, Danny. Yeah, Tyler.
So there's two elements to that. First off, the insurance industry, especially with respect to auto insurance, have been paying out on average about $1.10 for every $1 they collect in premium. So insurance companies over the last 2 years have been losing money. So insurance companies are not gouging. However, they do need parts and repair costs to pay their claims. To the extent that there are price increases or price gouging in that domain, it does impact the auto insurance premium.
Tyler Leverty is an associate professor of risk and insurance at the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. As we discuss increases in the cost of car insurance, call in with a question. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As car insurance policies continue to climb nationwide, we learn about why premiums are becoming more expensive, and we get the view from Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share your concerns at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler Leverty is an associate professor of risk and insurance at the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. Let's bring in a call. Laura in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I have a question regarding my partner and I. We're in a relationship, right? But he has his own house. I have my own house, own insurances. We both have our own car insurances. but my insurance company stated that he needed to be on my plan because he drives my car maybe once a month, if that. Is that true? Because if he's already covered under one insurance, why does he have to be on mine?
Laura, thank you. Tyler, what do you make of that scenario?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think I agree with the caller. I don't think it's necessary that you keep separate residents, separate cars. The other driver does not need to be on your insurance. So I'm sort of puzzled why the insurance company would request that. It would change if you were married, but given that you're not and you have separate residents, separate cars, auto insurance follows the owner of the car. And so they own separate cars. I think it's fine.
Laura, thank you for that call. Robert now in Stevens Point. Robert, hi.
Yes, good morning. Say, I'd like to ask your guest, why will rates vary from one provider to another? What are some of those reasons?
Okay. So the reason why insurance companies have various rates is they have different target markets, different underwriting standards, different expenses. And as a result, you know, one insurer may be focused on sort of a more of a high risk driver because they have sufficient number of insureds that fit that demographic. And so that allows them to feel comfortable in pricing and pooling those risks. Whereas another insurer prefers to insure low risk drivers that have, a clean driving record. And so it just depends on their target market and the statistics behind risk pooling that allows them to do what they do, which is effectively take risks from many, many, many different people. And because they collect it from a large group of people, they can predict losses within a pretty narrow range and essentially eliminate the risk.
So really these algorithms driving the policy and what is put forth by the insurer.
Yes. And I think that sort of that question brings up a relevant thing that a person can do to try to lower their insurance costs, and that is shop around, right? So if people find that their insurance rates have gone up significantly, one key way to save some money is to shop around because roughly about 70% of auto insurance owners, when they shopped around to find a better deal, they found it. And so that's a great way to try to reduce your auto insurance costs.
We see auto insurers like State Farm and Progressive and Allstate promising discounts if they can monitor your driving habits. Are programs like those worthwhile?
So it depends on the person. So if somebody's willing to have a telematics device in their vehicle and if they feel that they're a great driver, then that's a great program to have because there are significant discounts. And there's also a lot of evidence suggesting that when people use those, it can change their behavior and make them better drivers because they learn some of their weaknesses. And so if somebody's willing to have that in their vehicle, they are going to get a price discount. On the flip side, if you're a terrible driver and you know it, you maybe not want to install one of these drivers because the insurance company is going to quickly learn about that.
Let's bring in Margaret in Madison now. Margaret, hi.
Good morning. My question for your guest is, does the cost of reinsurance affect the premium that folks are paying? For insurers that write multiple lines, we know that there are areas in the country where they're spending a lot of money on homeowners, their reinsurance rates are going up. I'm wondering if that's affecting our cost of auto premium.
Well, that's an excellent question. You have a lot of insurance industry knowledge. Absolutely, the cost of reinsurance is going to find its way into the premium, your auto insurance premium, because most auto insurers are going to purchase reinsurance to protect them against their unforeseen losses. And so if that cost increases, that's going to lead to an increase for the policyholder. Now, you alluded to the fact that there's maybe some reinsurance price increases in, say, property lines, wildfire, like California, for example, or hurricanes in Florida. That probably won't find itself to large extent into auto insurance premiums,
okay.
But it would homeowners.
Margaret, thank you for that question. As we talk about the rise in auto insurance premiums, and we hear about it through Tyler Leberty, Associate Professor of Risk and Insurance at UW-Madison. Call in with questions. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. Examining natural disasters, the Minnesota Commissioner of Commerce says natural disasters are driving up insurance costs. How affected or exposed is Wisconsin compared to states that face more natural disasters like hurricanes or tornadoes?
Well, so convective storms, particularly like tornadoes and hailstorms, have a big impact on auto physical damage. Since these sort of events happen suddenly and affect hundreds or if not thousands of cars in one area, and so that cost of sort of the repair for body damage could be quite sizable. And so these types of events do indeed happen in Wisconsin and the Midwest, and those are probably the biggest cause of auto insurance losses. Obviously, there's hurricanes and floods that do not happen as much, the floods, at least in the Wisconsin area, but hailstorms and tornadoes do indeed.
So with flooded cars, though, how does your policy generally approach floods when a car is submerged?
Yeah, so first, floods are covered in auto insurance.
Okay.
And different than for homeowners. Homeowners insurance companies do not cover floods. That's covered under the National Flood Insurance Program. But for automobiles and auto physical damage, because of a flood, it will be covered by your auto insurer.
Are insurance companies changing how they assess whether a vehicle should be totaled from an accident?
Well, so if the cost of repair and replacement increases, and that goes that rises above the level which the total value of the car is, then that's going to be the influence. So the extent there, I don't think they're changing how they're doing this, but the repair and replacement costs, if those increase, it's going to increase the number of instances where they find that there's a total loss.
How can drivers know if their auto insurance coverage is adequate for the price they're paying?
So in the United States, we have a very low level of required insurance. Mm-hmm. I'm just comparing that to other rich countries like Great Britain or Germany. In the United States, we have sort of what I refer to like a Spartan car insurance. It sort of stands out in the rich world. We have legal minimum bodily injury coverage that obviously varies state by state, but nowhere does that minimum actually pass $100,000 per accident. Whereas in Germany, drivers are required to have over $8.2 million in coverage.
Wow.
In Britain, it's limited. And so to answer your question is I think if you're buying minimum limits, that's probably not going to be sufficient to cover the costs of accidents today. So it depends critically on sort of, you know, your comfort level of how much risk you're willing to bear outside of your insurance.
Well, Tyler, appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Tyler Leberty is an associate professor of risk and insurance at the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. Staying in this orbit, we're going to shift our attention to home insurance and what is going on in that marketplace. You can call in with a question. You can share your comments as we talk with a spokesperson for the Insurance Information Institute. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discussed the rising cost of home insurance and what to expect in Wisconsin. California-based Farmers Insurance showed the biggest jump in home insurance premiums for 2023, that analysis by S&P Global Market Intelligence. Cullen, with a question, you can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Scott Holman is a spokesperson for the Insurance Information Institute. Scott, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So this Policy Genius analysis shows Wisconsin homeowners insurance premiums grew 15% from May 2022 to May of last year. What is causing this increase?
Well, first I want to say Wisconsin tends to be among the lower priced states for home and auto insurance. So, but we are seeing this trend of both rates rising nationwide. And, you know, we've seen homeowners insurance premium rates rise significantly since the pandemic. And a lot of that can be attributed to supply chain issues and labor shortages. That's driving up the cost of home repairs and replacement. But there are some other long-term trends that also affect rates. And it's important for both consumers and policymakers to understand why this is happening and why it's probably going to continue. There are three key drivers for rate increases right now. We're seeing a rising number of catastrophic losses due to extreme weather events. Mm. We are also seeing people move into disaster-prone areas. More people are moving into harm's way. And then, again, we are seeing those increasing home repair and rebuilding costs.
So, stepping back here, why does Wisconsin trend lower in the cost of homeowners insurance and car insurance in Wisconsin? As you list those factors, why is Wisconsin trending lower?
Well, that could have to do with a variety of factors, including the claims experiences in that state, the number of people, the number of insurance companies doing business, all the way to how your insurance regulators are protecting the market in Wisconsin. There are a variety of factors that that help determine where rates are going.
Your institute reports suggest homeowners insurance was unprofitable in 4 out of 5 years from 2017 to 2021. How much were these unprofitable? What is that factor like?
Well, there's something in insurance that determines how profitability is measured. You know, any business needs to make a reasonable profit. And insurers' underwriting profitability is measured by what's called the combined ratio. And that's a calculation that divides losses and expenses by earned premium. So a combined ratio under 100% indicates a profit for the company. A ratio above 100 indicates a loss. And in four of the last 5 years, it's been unprofitable. So think of it as if every dollar going being paid to an insurance company is going out, that sets the combined ratio at 100. If more dollars are going out than coming in, that's going to be above 100. And that's where we're going to see those losses for companies. And, you know, insurance companies don't just rely on premiums. They take money that they have in reserves and they invest that. But they are required by law and their regulators to keep certain reserves on hand. And so they can't keep spending that down. And, you know, they need to keep the money that is has been invested with them by policyholders, that in case there is an emergency, that money's there to pay out those claims and award that promise to pay.
But that must become very tricky, that reserve, that cushion, when you have populations moving into disaster-prone areas. What are those dynamics?
Well, you're right. And in the past year, we've seen losses for insurance companies pile up because of storms, natural disasters, inflation. So many companies are in the red, but it's not just places like that we hear of in the news a lot, like Florida, where there are hurricanes, and California, where there are wildfires. Last year, we saw states like Arkansas and Mississippi get hit by major tornadoes in the first half of the year. But the result is from this activity is since the start of last year, regulators have approved double-digit rate increases in at least 31 states, according to analysis by S&P Global. You know, some of the states have had really big ones. Arizona, Texas, North Carolina, Oregon, Illinois, and Utah had some of the biggest approved increases, ranging from 20 to 30%. And we're seeing some companies halting sales of new policies. You know, insurance is a very competitive industry, but with some of the trends that are out there, insurance companies are going to have to take a look at how they're doing business and what they're selling. You know, I know we're concentrating on homeowners here, but you saw in Wisconsin, it started in Wisconsin, the Kia Hyundai auto trends. You know, when you see events that are really having an impact on the market, there's going to be a reaction to that.
Scott Holman, a spokesperson for the New York City-based Insurance Information Institute, as we discuss homeowners insurance. And you can join in, questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Eugene in Viola is here. Eugene, hi.
Good morning. I've got about a 10-room Victorian. I've had it a little better than 50 years. When it was built, it was wired for a 32-volt light plant. It's still got knob and tube wiring and 60-amp service. And I had insurance at one time, but I can't find it now. I've never had any troubles with the wiring because I never overload the circuits very much. I can't find insurance.
So you can't find insurance for this old Victorian home that has, you know, knob and tube wiring. Scott, have you heard issues like this before?
Well, I'm not sure how much shopping around you've done. You might want to consult an insurance broker who works on behalf of a consumer. It's brokers and agents are a little bit different. Agents sell directly and they work on behalf of companies. Brokers work on behalf of the consumers and they shop around and try to find the kind of coverage you need. Have you tried the surplus lines market, or those are usually very specific kind of high risk situations?
Surplus lines market? What do you mean by that?
Surplus lines are if you're not getting if you can't get what you need in home and automobile companies, there are companies that specialize in what's called surplus lines, and so there are other kind of specialized insurance. But this caller, Eugene, might want to consult with an insurance broker to do some shopping around for him, or see if he can reach out to someone who sells surplus line products who may be able to offer some assistance.
Eugene, thank you for that call. Nate from Milwaukee called in. Nate's curious how insurance companies pool homes to make sure the risk is appropriate for the location. For instance, Nate says, do rates in Wisconsin go up alongside homes in Florida?
Well, insurance is all about spreading the risk, but it is related to the market you're in. So it should follow what the trends are where you live and in your market. So you shouldn't have to worry about subsidizing in Florida. And Florida is a completely different situation. They have, if any of their insurance companies get in trouble, they have what's called, it's a high risk pool that is like the insurer of last resort that people can get insurance from. But if that runs out of money, if there's a disaster and they run out of money, any person who has insurance, whether it's home or auto, get a special tax to help cover that. So that, but that's a different situation than, I don't know of any other state where that happens, but that's a situation in Florida. But spreading the risk in your state, and your insurance regulator at the Wisconsin Insurance Department, they are watching this, and if you're concerned about that, that is a great resource for you to ask questions or find out how they're regulating your local market.
Would an insurance company like refuse to renew a policy because or give you a policy because of a home's condition or its age?
Well, they certainly could. You know, mitigation is a crucial factor, and it's becoming more and more important to protecting our property. That you know, containing or reducing premium rates. That requires gaining control over claims. And so preemptive measures to protect your property is very important. And you know, fortunately right now, the InsurTech space is providing a lot of solutions that can help. You can take steps to reduce weather-related damage by installing smart home technology that detects certain vulnerabilities like plumbing leaks before they result in a claim. And when you do some of this mitigation, whether it's getting a grade A roof if you're in a hurricane area, or if you're taking care of vegetation around your home if you're in a wildfire prone area, these mitigation steps, make sure that you're reporting those to your insurance professional and ask what discounts you may qualify for. But make sure that they know that you're doing this, because that could impact the amount of rates that you have. But, you know, we're of the belief that we all need to be risk managers in today's world. There's a responsibility for everyone, whether it's communities, consumers, policymakers, and the insurance industry, to help improve how and where we're living. You know, the simple fact is more and more people are living in harm's way, and it's really essential for us to shift from detecting and repairing loss events to predicting and preventing damage and loss before it occurs. And so that's why it's important for us to look for some of those solutions to help through tech devices, and but also policymakers to maybe make some decisions about where we're building and where, you know, people are deciding to live.
Scott Holman is with the Insurance Information Institute as we discuss home insurance policies and the view in Wisconsin. You can call in with a question. Share your insights at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the factors in home insurance policy rates rising by double digits in 2023 and strategies for how to shop for a policy here in Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share your comments along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Scott Holman is with the Insurance Information Institute. So, Scott, the Institute says labor and material costs are factors affecting homeowners' insurance premiums. What materials are becoming more expensive in recent years?
Well, if you make a trip to the hardware store, almost everything you purchase there, you're going to see, whether it's wood or roofing materials. So just about everything has gone up since the pandemic.
Everything is going up, and that means that those costs go right into, you know, to those policies.
Correct.
And the Institute expecting premium rates will need to increase in the years ahead. How long should homeowners expect rates to go up?
Well, until we can get a reversal on some of these trends, I think that we should expect to see some increases. There is something that is important that I think that consumers should talk about with their insurance professional. And that's, we recommend that every year you have a conversation with your insurance professional to talk about what's changed in your situation. Do you have kids that are no longer living at home? Have you made an improvement to your kitchen? Make sure you have those conversations so that you have that right amount of coverage. You don't want to have too much. You don't want to have too little. And you don't want any surprises that if you have to file a claim that, you know, for some reason you're not getting what you expected. There are different kinds of coverage that you get when purchasing homeowner insurance. One, there's actual cash value, and that policy pays to replace the home or possessions minus a deductible for depreciation. So if building costs are high, that's probably not the kind of policy you want. It'll give you what your home at the time is worth minus depreciation. There's replacement cost coverage, which replaces without a deduction, but then there's also something called guaranteed or extended replacement costs, and that policy offers the highest level of protection. And a guaranteed replacement cost policy pays whatever it costs to rebuild the home as it was before, say, a fire or whatever disaster, even if it exceeds the policy limit.
And along those lines, as you explain replacement cost and actual cash value. There was a report from UW Extension showing medium home sale prices jumped more than 150% from 2012 to 2023. How can Wisconsin homeowners find out if they're underinsured?
Well, you want to make sure that you trust the valuation that's placed on your home, and you want to make sure that if you're seeing those values change, you want to make sure that you're talking to your insurance professional to make sure that that person understands what the market is, and then and go over what you would need if something happens. You don't want any surprises, and that's why you want to make sure that if there are changes that you make or enhancements that you make, you want to report that. But you also want to ask, if you're doing some of these things, can that give me a bit of a discount? One thing we should also point out for people is we recommend that everyone have what's called a home inventory. This is a document, and most companies that sell insurance have apps that are available for your smartphone. If you've got teenage kids who like to play with the phone, give it to them. Take video, take pictures, go from room to room, open drawers and doors, take an inventory of what you own. And for those high-priced items and electronics, if you can save copies of receipts or click pictures of serial numbers, keep this record and go room by room and keep that record and make sure that you store that in the cloud or someplace safe so that if you have a fire or something happens, if you have to file a claim, that's going to make that process so much easier, and it's going to give you a peace of mind. You may think you know what you own, but if you were suddenly to lose everything, close your eyes and go from room to room, can you remember everything that's there? Probably not. For women who have expensive purses and shoes, make sure that you're documenting items like that. Go really through everything that you have, and then talk about your coverage needs and your level of potential risk with your insurance professional to find out what you need. You know, one thing that a lot of people don't have is flood insurance. And, you know, when you're shopping for a home, a lot of times realtors will tell you, well, you're not in a floodplain, you don't need to worry about that. We like to say, if it rains where you live, you need to consider flood insurance. And that's sold through the National Flood Insurance Program. And more private insurers are starting to sell it. But, if you have a basement and it floods as a result of rain, that's not covered by a standard homeowner's policy. So we're hopeful that more and more people will really understand the kind of risk they're exposed to, and especially as we're seeing, climate changes impact the kind of weather we're seeing.
Scott Holman is with the Insurance Information Institute as we discuss homeowners insurance. You can call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Anne is here in Mequon. Anne, hi.
Hi, thank you so much. I have a question about replacement contents in a home. If you have a fire and the house burns down, and you have $300,000 worth of coverage. I had a friend in Colorado whose house burned down in the mountains, and she had to replace her content basically with in kind. So in other words, if you had 50 shirts, you had to replace them with 50 shirts. If you only replaced 40 of the shirts, you didn't get that money that you've been paying insurance, for. So she said, she felt like she didn't understand her policy and what that replacement contents is. So my question is, if you have, let's say, $200,000 in replacement contents, would you just be given a check if you had a total disaster? Or would you have to document every purchase you made with the insurance company?
Anne, thank you for that. Scott?
Well, that's why it's really important to have some conversations before you buy a policy to make sure that you understand what's going to happen if you need to file a claim. As I mentioned just a few minutes ago, there are different kinds of policies that you can purchase. You will be having to show, what you've lost. And that's going to vary from what kind of documents you have to what, if it's a fire, there's going to be probably some reports with your fire department and things that are available, but go over with your insurance professional about what kind of replacement that your policy covers. I said earlier that insurance is a very competitive industry and there are a lot of people competing for your business, and you probably can't watch a TV show or a football game without getting those messages.
Without seeing Dr. Rick from Progressive.
So
specifically,
it is so competitive, they're different. They write their policies differently. So that's why it's important to ask questions and to find out what you have, because you don't want to be surprised if you have a fire and lose something that it's not being settled in the manner of which you expected. You know, we encourage people to shop around annually, to make sure that you're getting the good rate, but also talk to your friends and family who have insurance and find out what their experiences are. Talk to people who've had to file a claim and say, what did you learn? What did you not know? What would you recommend?
Gather that information. Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Scott Holman is a spokesperson for the Insurance Information Institute. If you visit our program page, you can stream or download more programs from the morning show. If you miss part of our conversation, you can stream a recording later on at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network.